Afternoon, everybody. It's nice to see everyone. Let's go first.
I just want that to be on the record.
House Judiciary is in session. Today's the final day of Judiciary for the session, is that right? I think, I believe.
Oh, rock on.
Knock on wood.
Unless you want to have an 8 a.m. meeting tomorrow morning?
Six.
Nice. In attendance are Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Samuels, Representative Holmes. Vice Chair is at a press conference doing the Aegea dance. We're going to take up House Bill 255, SB 141, and then we're going to make a change, bring HJR 2 back before us to make one language change. We'll go over in some point in time. I'd like to take up House Bill 255 first. Jeannie, nice to see you. So introduce yourself and introduce the bill. Appreciate it.
We're going to HR 2.
It's that new hotel that's opening up near the airport from us.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeannie Osnes. I'm staff to Representative Craig Johnson. Okay. And House Bill 255 is before you, proposing to expand the dual sentencing provisions. It has a number of changes in the front end of the bill. It adds a few things and clarifies some others, brings in some specific age ranges. Anthony Newman from Department of Health and Social Services is here to go into some of the details regarding dual sentencing. And that's kind of the crux of the bill. You want
Representative? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just, I just want to ask this question now because I might have to duck out in a minute. I didn't see any letters of support in the packet. Are we going to have people online testifying about what's prompting this, what the Department of Law thinks, what Corrections thinks, all the other departments?
We were supposed to have Rick Savotny here, but I believe he's up with House Bill 90. We pretty much discussed the possibility of finding a list of things that there may be questions for Department of Law to look at.
Yes, go ahead. We're Representative Holmes, we're not moving this bill today. We're introducing it as a bill to allow the sponsor to take it up over the interim.
Mr. Chairman, I think there was a gentleman here that wanted to interject a thought on that.
Great.
Good afternoon, Chairman Ramirez. My name is Tony Newman. I'm Program Officer at the Division of Juvenile Justice, and I've prepared some testimony if I could share it with you this afternoon. I think it'll help address the questions.
Is that appropriate?
Wonderful. Thank you.
I thank you again for allowing me to speak with you today, and I'm also grateful to Representative Johnson and to Jeannie for talking with the Division of Juvenile Justice about youth violence and our mutual concerns. A few weeks ago, Representative Johnson had the director of our division, Steve McComb, and me to his office to talk about his concerns and for us to share ours with him. Like many of you and like many agencies around the state, the staff at the Division of Juvenile Justice have been concerned about youth violence. Although we've been pleased to witness an overall decrease in referrals of delinquent juveniles to our division for the past several years, and like to think that our work with them has played a role in that, we remain concerned about unacceptable levels of felony crimes, crimes against persons, weapons crimes, particularly in Anchorage, where gangs are a concern for so many of us. We've been trying to look critically at our agency, and one of our major concerns had to do with the small percentage of young people who come to us as violent offenders and who put their time in with us, but despite our best efforts at restoration and rehabilitation, reach the end of their juvenile order and walk out of McLaughlin Youth Center or Fairbanks Youth Facility, and who remain a public safety concern but can't be supervised or monitored because they've reached 19 years of age and the juvenile jurisdiction has ended. If you go into any of our youth facilities and talk to staff there, they'll be able to tell you stories of youth that they've had who've grown up into young adults and who they knew would be dangerous and who sure enough went on to careers as adult criminals. We began to ask ourselves if there was a way to provide some measure of public safety regarding these offenders, while at the same time assuring that they had indeed been given every opportunity to succeed in the juvenile system. So that led us to examine the existing dual sentencing law. The details of that law can be found in AS 4712065 and 4712120. The idea is that for committing certain offenses, a juvenile can receive both a juvenile order and an adult sentence. And the adult sentence only kicks in once the juvenile has failed the juvenile system in some way. For instance, by committing another felony, by trying to by escaping from the facility, or by failing to meet treatment goals. According to our staff, the problem with the existing dual sentencing law is that the criteria that would make a youth eligible for it are so stringent that the law is almost never used as an option. And sure enough, reviewing division data on this, we've found only 4 cases of a youth receiving a dual sentence in the 10 or so years since it's been on the books. And then only one of those wound up with any kind of sanction in the adult system. Under the bill introduced by Representative Johnson, the types of offenses and ages of juveniles eligible for dual sentencing would be expanded. We estimate that about 55 more juveniles a year would be eligible for dual sentencing, but because many of them will not be determined to be appropriate candidates for it by the department or by the district attorney, the actual number who might end up being referred for dual sentencing would probably be significantly less than about 55 juveniles, but at least this would give the state an additional option to work to assure the public safety. So our hope then is that an expanded dual sentencing law would enable us to provide seriously dangerous juvenile offenders with an opportunity and the motivation to succeed in the juvenile justice system and lessen calls to simply transfer these youths to the adult system without giving them that chance to succeed. We also hope to provide a range of options on how youth who do not respond to juvenile services can be dealt with, such as by ensuring the possibility of suspended sentences and probation instead of simply requiring that they be placed in prison. We would also expect and hope that it would require us to do a better job of understanding and justifying the treatment that juveniles receive in our treatment facilities, why the treatment has succeeded or failed when the question of whether to recommend transfer of the juvenile to the adult system arises. So that said, it's important that the division go on record as acknowledging that we have a number of concerns about the bill in its current form. We believe the bill needs some additional language to ensure that those younger offenders in particular are not bumped into the adult system prematurely. One of the reactions I've heard about this bill is that it appears as if it's intended to put 12-year-olds in adult prison. And that's certainly not our intention, nor I'm sure is the sponsor's intention. The bill needs some work to make it clear that a youth under a certain age, say 17, 16, has no place in adult prison until they've really been given that chance to succeed in the juvenile system. The bill needs to clarify how a youth who successfully completes juvenile treatment can avoid adult prison time or have the adult sentence possibly dismissed. And the age limits and the offense types that the bill would open up for dual sentencing need significant scrutiny and input from our partners in law enforcement, corrections, prosecutors, defenders, and the courts. So let me emphasize again, the Division of Juvenile Justice does not want to see 12-year-olds going to adult jail. We don't want to see any juvenile go to adult jail, really. Our staff view keeping kids from becoming adult criminals is their most important and rewarding aspect of their work. The evidence is solid that the juvenile system leads to the best outcomes for juvenile offenders to help them avoid a life of crime and victimizing others. So while we want to continue to work to help juveniles succeed, though, we also recognize that we have a duty to protect public safety as best we can. That's why we've worked with Representative Johnson on this bill, and that's why we think it deserves some consideration. So with that, I've tried to give you a clear-eyed analysis of the bill, and I'm happy to stick around and answer any questions you have.
What's the recidivism rate amongst juveniles? Recidivism rate while they're juveniles, but do you know what the statistic is for those juveniles who go on to be adults? Is it a significant recidivism rate that they reoffend as adults?
Mr. Chairman, that's an excellent question, and it depends on how we define recidivism. At the Division of Juvenile Justice, we define recidivism as have they reoffended in either the juvenile or adult system within a year of their, say, release from a treatment facility or within a year from their release from formal probation, since most kids are placed on probation. That rate is 28%.
So it's relatively low relative to the I rescind that sentence. The rate is considerably less than the recidivism rate of adults that reoffend into as adults. That recidivism rate is 66%. Mm-hmm. So we really have an opportunity to rescue a significant part of the juvenile offender population. Don't repeat either in the juvenile system or in the adult system, but when you use a one-year increment. Do you use any other increments to measure recidivism?
Not currently. We have looked, in the past, the division used to look at a two-year window. But in trying to align ourselves more with the way other states around the country are defining recidivism, we've gone to a one-year window.
So, just one second. So if you offended when you were 15 and then you didn't offend again until you were 19, you wouldn't fall into that statistical captured demographic?
Mr. Chairman, if you were released from, say, a juvenile facility when you were 15 and you reoffended when you were 19, you would not be captured. But I should point out that the research seems to show that most people who recidivate tend to do so
quickly.
Quickly, exactly.
Okay, I understand. Representative Coghill and then Sanders.
I'll defer to the representative. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the lines of the recidivism, legislative budget and audit had a request from me, actually, to do an audit on all the various recidivism rates, because DJJ may do one, corrections may do another. All of these private nonprofits, they have different standards, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, so that when you see the statistics, they became, you know, irrelevant, actually. So what the audit has done, and it will become public as soon as we can have a meeting sometime in the next couple of weeks, the first couple of weeks after the session, that analysis came back, and if you would like, we could have a hearing on that sometime during the summer. It was a fascinating review when it was still private, before it went back to the agencies. It was a fascinating look at how recidivism statistics are done, and it'll give you a really clear idea of numbers, you know, which, you know, as we start looking at funding programs for substance abuse, which ones succeed and which ones do not succeed. And that was the point of the goal, was to try to look at which don't fund the ones that have high recidivism rates. So if you'd like, once we just release to the public, if you'd want, we can do something.
That'd be a great Representative Coghill.
One of the other issues is not only the spread of time between 15 and 19 and the timeline, but when people age out of the juvenile system and or do not offend in the adult system. And then depends on what they're charged at. Some things are more serious at 16, some 18, and some 19. And so I don't know how we'll look at all that, but certainly when it comes to this dual sentencing, it's a pretty egregious affair. So, but I think the aging out still could be an issue here.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I've got one question for anybody that knows the answer. A B felony against a person, if the class A, classified and unclassified, or murder one, murder two, sex assault one, two, manslaughter, arson, I think that's probably it. What would be a B felony against a person? Is that assault two?
Assault second degree is B.
And how is assault two defined? I mean, is it by the amount of injury to somebody, or?
I should defer to the Department of Law, but I guess they're not here.
And I can ask later, right. Or if you can give me the answer later.
But I believe it tends to be more about the weapon or the lack of a weapon that was used.
Quick question, just while we have you here. All the members received discretionary spending, and just by happenstance, Bernard Gatewood with the youth facility, they had done they wanted to do this painter, Charlene Jeffries, wanted to go in and help the juvenile population at the Fairbanks Correctional Youth facility paint. They didn't have any money for the painting. It was a couple of years ago. So I directed to some of my discretionary money to the youth facility, because the recidivism rates there are so much more encouraging than they are at the adult facilities. In adult facilities, I'm more inclined, a lot of the prisoners need to stay in prison for the betterment of the community. But for the youth population, you know, I want to see them get well and emerge as contributing members of our society. What kind of things will they be able to do? I think I allocated $5,000, $10,000 to the youth facility up in Fairbanks. What kind of things will they be able to do with that discretionary money?
Mr. Chairman, I think that they would be able to do any number of things. One thing might be, since that's that'd be hard to add, make a renovation or an addition with that sort of funding. But exercise equipment for the juveniles, a climbing wall, I think I've heard mentioned as a desired need in Fairbanks.
That's what they're, I don't know, is Bernard Gatewood, is he their supervisor, the warden, what do you call
him? He's the superintendent.
He's the superintendent. So that was what he indicated, that, and when he said exercise equipment, I thought, well, I don't want these kids to come out buffed up, and he talked more about cardio type of equipment. Are there, because I meant it to be kind of like after school, the equivalent of after school funding, you know, the way that I did for the Future Farmers of America, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of programs will they be able to benefit from? What helps to strengthen, you know, the spirits and the self-esteem of those young people, since it's a different environment, obviously, than the public school system?
Mr. Chairman, one of the most beneficial things you can do for a young person is get them some job skills. And we're real proud of Bernard for his work he's done in developing a culinary arts program up at the Fairbanks Youth Facility. And maybe he could use some enhancement of that program through that.
Good. Okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
One extra thing is one of the teachers that goes to the Fairbanks Correctional Center, the Youth Center, is I think her name is Johnston, Mrs. Johnston, from West High. She goes there after her classes are done, teaches the kids there, and her job at West High School is to train kids how to get jobs and do things that are getting them into resumes and getting ready for an interview, and she's found that was a skill that these kids were lacking and has helped with that.
Good, excellent. So when I speak with Bernard Gatewood, I might thank him for his work on the culinary program and suggest to him that those would be excellent areas. A little cardio and some cardio equipment and the culinary program, and then some job skills work, job skill type. Lost for words. Okay.
Enhancement,
thank you. Okay, are there other questions? Because we have a couple other people that we have Charlene Griffin. Is Charlene here? Okay. For any questions, we're going to set this bill aside and give Representative Johnson the summer to work on it and to put together his program. But we wanted to, he had requested that we hear it, to give it a cursory hearing. Are there any questions from any of the members? Okay, seeing none, we thank you very much and thanks for the overview. And if you want to get with our office or with Representative Samuel's office through LBNA, it'd be fascinating to have a some kind of a conference in Anchorage sometime this summer.
Yeah, and also, Mr. Chairman, the Judicial Council came out a report earlier this year on recidivism as well. But I think you'll find interesting, as soon as we can release, which we tried to do 7 o'clock yesterday morning, we ran out of time. So yes. But when we get to that, I will make sure that we have to get something set up.
Yes, thank you very much. And there's all these fish hatchery bills on the floor.
What's that?
There's all these fish hatchery bills on the floor. All right. So with that, let's go to Senate Bill 141. Hi.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members.
We're happy to see you. If you'll introduce yourself and the LLC bill that's before us. And for the members' benefit, we have Mr. Chaffetel is on the line, available to answer questions. Hi.
Hi, thanks. For the record, my name is Mara Carlson Van Dort. I'm staff for Senator McGuire. And I'm here this afternoon to put before you Senate Bill 141, which is one bill of three, which is, this is a co-sponsor of one bill of three, which was introduced by this committee during this session. And what we're attempting to address here is to keeping Alaska's trust laws, LLC laws, business laws competitive and attractive to people that want to come and do business in the state of Alaska. This bill, in particular, like I said, is one of three aimed at keeping Alaska a premier place, but it will clarify in statutory language that an organization providing professional services can organize its business using a limited liability company. This is things that are quite frankly, probably already taking place, and this is just a statutory clarification. The reason for this is that there can be no speculation on the authority of the use of an LLC for professional services, as they are defined in statute. Professional services, accountants, lawyers, things which require licensing. In addition, this bill deletes subsection D of AS 0.50.150, which allows a founder of an Alaskan LLC to be a co-manager without having all the assets of the company included in the founder's gross estate for federal tax purposes. And really, this is clarification. This is cleanup language to our statutes, and in a best effort to keep them attractive to people wanting to do business in the state.
This is the same bill that I introduced. I think it moved through this committee as House Bill 195, and for reasons I can't explain, did not get a hearing in House Labor and Commerce after repeated requests, Mr. Rules Chairman. Anyway, we're delighted to have the Senate bill with the exact same title and content before us.
Well, it's our honor to present it to you.
Oh, the honor is all mine, believe me. We've already heard this bill. Did it go to LNC first? Is that where it went first?
Mm-hmm.
If accountants, you'll see a professional corporation, and accountants and professionals are regarded as individuals, and an LLC is the same thing as an individual. Which is why, sub S corporations.
Lindsay's watching real close on this.
Do you know
I'm
this
listening.
Stuff? Do you know this?
I'm not entirely sure where we're going.
She's done a lot of them.
Well, then I'm going to shut up. I'm going to go to Mr. Schaftel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mara, you referenced a change in the bill that pertained to one of the co-owners of the LLC could be the manager.
That's correct.
What line is that specifically on this bill?
It's page 2, line 5. It's section 4, and repeals subsection D.
Okay,
of the existing statute.
Yeah.
And then, can you explain to me? I understand the change then and what it would do, but if the LLC got in trouble, and the managing partner, who's also an owner, maybe is the person that got him in that situation, or was a co-conspirator, you know, with another partner. How does that work out to be fair? Would they get let off the hook for something that the other partners or other people would potentially be charged with, but they would have the benefit of having earned money and interest off of the gains of the LLC?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, that's an interesting question, and I think the best person to address that would be Dave Schaftel. He's quite knowledgeable in this.
Okay, thank you.
All roads lead to Dave Schaftel. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I'd like to state a conflict. I am a partner in two LLCs.
Not professional corporation.
They are. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They are not providing professional services, but the actual who knows how this ends.
Right.
I just wanted to put that on the record.
Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, Representative Samuels? I mean, I see the ethical road that we are all on these days. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just state also that I'm a member of an LLC.
State also, I have an LLC. Okay, with that,
Mr. Chairman, I want to be.
you ought to talk to your wife. You ought to be.
He should talk to me. We can set one up.
Yeah. I think I'll do that.
How's the how flower shop?
You yeah. ought to be. Can we go to Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of House Judiciary. This bill is really intended to, as the legislative assistant stated, first just clarify that professionals can use an LLC as their business entity. And in fact, this has been done over the past 15 years or so since we've had LLCs authorized in Alaska. The Division of Corporations approves the use of LLCs by groups of professionals, whether they're doctors, lawyers, engineers, accountants, licensed professionals in Alaska. But the statute, which was drafted, and I actually was part of the group that initially worked on the draft of the LLC statute that was submitted to the legislature for its consideration back in, I think it was 1993-1994, quite frankly, we did not, you know, we overlooked putting in this authority at that time. And so this initial provision that we're talking about here just clarifies that professionals can indeed use LLCs, and in fact they are, and you probably have seen that yourselves when you go to a doctor's office or an engineer's office, and you'll see that often they are using an LLC as the entity of choice. The advantage of an LLC is that it combines the best attributes of a corporation in the partnership. It has limited liability, just as if you were using a corporation, but it has a single level of taxation, just as if you were using a partnership. And this is why they have become really the entities of choice for any business, whether it's a family business, a small family business, or a small investment activity by a family, or whether it's an operating business that you see around town. Only occasionally do we now see businesses formed as corporations, and usually that's because, for example, you may be dealing with a bank that is federally regulated, or another company that intends to go public, and then they may choose the corporate form. Generally, an LLC is significantly easier to use than an S corporation, especially when you get into the estate planning area, which allows us to go into the second part of this bill. And maybe I should stop there and see if that's an adequate explanation of just the first provision. Are there any questions about that part of it?
Representative Samuels.
Mr. Sheftel, I've got a question on the repeal of Section 4, the repeal of 1050-150D. And I don't know if you've not gotten there or not, but I had questions on that.
Let me cover that. That's the second part of this bill, and that gets into this area of using family limited liability companies like family limited partnerships for estate planning. And this is very commonly done and has been done since the late 1980s. And it's a very useful approach for a family to use where you can often the senior members of the family, the parents, will contribute investment assets, real estate, maybe business interests, maybe securities accounts into a family limited partnership. They will, over a period of years, make gifts of those interests to their children, to their grandchildren, or trusts for their grandchildren, and so it allows a commingling, a centralized management of assets, a diversification of assets, and a way to pass those assets along to the next generation, free of transfer tax, gift tax, or estate tax. And the reason for that is everybody can transfer up to $12,000 per year per beneficiary. And on top of that, everyone over their lifetime can transfer an amount of $1 million without paying any gift tax. So these entities are commonly used for this purpose, but a problem has developed where the founders, the senior generation, retain too much control. And this comes under Section 2036A2 of the Internal Revenue Code. And the IRS has, in a number of situations, challenged family limited partnerships or family LLCs where, in their opinion, the founders have kept too much control over that entity, because subsection A2 says that if the founder who's doing this gifting retains the ability to affect distributions, and that can be alone or with any other person or groups of persons, doesn't even have to have majority control, or even, and there are a couple of cases that actually have stated this, although it's dicta so far, even if that founder could vote on liquidation of the entity, because Section 2036A2 says if you contribute assets to an entity like a trust or a partnership and retain the ability to affect the enjoyment of those assets by a beneficiary, then those assets will be included in your estate and taxed when you die. Well, you could have a situation where the founder, the parents, set up a family limited partnership and over 20 years gave away almost all of the interest and only had small interest left. And yet the IRS, if they were managers and had total management authority over that family LLC, they could affect when distributions would be made. And they also could vote on liquidation, and the IRS could take the position, wherein it has in a number of cases, and say, all of these assets, even though you gave them away over a 20-year period, and you used your annual exclusion gifting, the $12,000 a year, and you filed gift tax returns, and you used your million-dollar ability to gift over that period of time, nevertheless, all of those assets are back into your estate and taxed under the estate tax at your death. Now, because of this interpretation by the IRS, and because of some cases, and basically what the IRS is saying is don't retain too much control. And so the planning technique that has developed to avoid this problem is to have two types of managers. The senior generation may well say, we want to still control how these assets are invested. We've been doing that over our lifetimes. We built up these assets. We know how to do it. But we're willing to have a special manager, a separate manager who's independent, make distribution decisions, when distributions would be made pro rata to all the owners of the LLC. And that person would have the right to vote and decide if ever the LLC would be liquidated. And so we get into these two different categories of managers, and this has been the approved technique to deal with this issue that I've been describing. Now, the problem, when you do this, you also have to make sure that the senior generation, these founding members, can't vote on changing this special manager arrangement, because if they could, again, that would be enough for the IRS, even though they didn't have majority voting control, that would be enough for the IRS to come back and say 2036A2 applies and all these assets need to be included in their gross estates. Now, subsection D posed a problem for us, and again, that subsection went into the statute back in 1994 before any of these issues were even talked about, because this whole 2036 area, it's only been the last 6 years or so that cases have come down and the IRS has pursued it. But it has this section that, in effect, says that the required level of consent has to be at least a majority. And we can have a situation where, let's say, a senior family member created an LLC and gave away 49% but kept 51%. And with this provision, which is not waivable at the present time, unless it's repealed, it says that senior family member would have to vote. And that, in effect, prevents the kind of planning that we're talking about. Now, there's no purpose for this subsection D. It doesn't seem to serve any valid purpose, and so repealing it isn't going to do any harm. But it will allow the kind of planning that we're talking about. And right now, it's kind of an anachronistic provision that flows back to the old you know, Model Act that we were working with back in 1993 and 1994 when we put together an act to submit to the legislature. So that's, I'm sorry it's such a complex explanation as to why the Section 4 is in the bill, but that's what it's all about.
Thank you. I do have a follow-up question, actually. I almost read it to ask, but if you're not talking, you're talking about a definitely like a family trust type scenario, but in an ongoing business, could you have a four-person LLC, a four-person, was essentially a four-person partnership, ending up with where they're under duress, you got a couple of partners who agree to amend the articles of organization, then you don't need the majority of the members anymore to make changes, and essentially your four-person partnership is now controlled by one entity, by one of your partners, because of a certain sequence of events that happened at a certain part of time right there. And I'm probably not phrasing the question very well, but I never thought of this from a trust, from a family trust scenario, but I thought of it more as an ongoing business. Do you want to end up with a situation where equal partners can get shoved out of the decision-making process because you wouldn't no longer meet a requirement of the majority of the members?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, is that?
Yes.
Yes. This provision, repealing this provision, will not in any way prevent the formation of a LLC, whether it's a business LLC or a family LLC, in any way that the members want to structure it. And that's one of the beauties of the LLC law in our act and generally of LLC acts. They are very flexible. So it will only be in situations where a family desires to have this kind of structure with a special manager. And the family gets together and the senior family members and the junior family members all agree that this would be advisable.
Mr. Schaftel?
Yes, yes, sir.
This would apply to things that are not family-owned. This is every LLC, and I don't think I'm clarifying my question. I'll give you an example. If me and my three partners in an LLC, if I wanted to get some cash out of the LLC rather than have it be in the company, and they go, well, we'll give you the cash disbursement, but in order to do that, we're going to change the rules where amend the articles of organization to where just the person who doesn't want the cash is now in control. So the three people, if you want the cash, I take control, and I no longer need the majority of the members. I'm not talking to I understand the deal with the trust and the parents. I get all that. I'm looking at more as an ongoing business. And if I'm misreading this, and quite frankly, I probably am, but that's the question, is an ongoing business.
Yes, and the answer is that you would only find yourself in that kind of a predicament if you had agreed to an operating agreement that contained those kinds of terms. Because what you're doing with this statute in no way imposes that kind of structure on any business LLC. It just allows the freedom for the people who are involved in an LLC to draft an operating agreement the way they want to. So the answer is no. There would be no trap like that because of repeal of this provision. That doesn't do that at all. And I hope I'm addressing that adequately for you, but that is the answer.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Schaftel. Next in line, we have Mr. Steve Greer. Steve, if you could identify yourself and your affiliation, we'd love to hear your testimony. All right, Steve is no longer with us. Mr. Schaftel, did you hear the question that I asked the bill presenter a little while ago about the liability potential for or lack of liability for a managing partner if wrongdoing is done?
Yes.
Could you speak to that?
Representative Dahlstrom?
Yes.
Yes. The If you are a member of an LLC and you are guilty of wrongdoing yourself, you are still liable. This, an LLC doesn't protect you from your individual liability. It only protects from business liabilities, just like a corporation. If the business itself incurs a liability, what an LLC says is that its members are not personally liable for that business liability. So if you are running a trucking business and one of your drivers is negligent and gets in an accident and the business is sued and there aren't enough assets in the business, then the person who has that judgment cannot go after the members who own the business, just the same as if it was a corporation. But if you were that truck driver and a member of the LLC, you were driving the truck as well and you were negligent, you're always liable. If you are guilty of the wrongdoing, whether it's an LLC or a corporation or any other entity, you cannot avoid liability.
Okay, let me ask you a question with a different example. So you have a business, and they decide to close their doors and go out of business, and they have outstanding debts, and they're an LLC.
Again,
can the debtors then go put liens against their personal property that had nothing to do with their LLC?
Generally, no. The only way that would happen is if the members of the LLC had personally guaranteed these debts when they were incurred. Now, sometimes that is done, because if you go to the bank and ask for, you have an LLC and you want to go out and buy some real estate, and the bank looks at the LLC and says, you know, we're not convinced that the assets of that LLC, including the real estate that you're buying, are going to be adequate to secure this loan, and the only way we'll secure it is if each of the members personally signs, well, then you would be responsible for that debt. But if you have an operating business and that business just fails over a period of time and all of its liabilities were incurred in the business name and not in the members' names, and none of them guaranteed those liabilities, then they would not be responsible.
Okay, so just a legal clarification for me. So in my mind, anytime I sign my name on anything, I'm guaranteeing, and that's a guarantee that I'm going to follow through. So unless I sign a special piece of paper with a loan that says I really mean what I said on that other piece of paper I signed, I could get off the hook then.
Well, it depends on how you sign. If you were to sign, for example, as a manager of the LLC, and it was clear to the person who was extending credit or providing services or whatever it is that's going to create this debt, if you were acting just for the LLC, then you would not be personally liable. But if it said, if where you sign said, and I personally guarantee this obligation, then you would be personally liable. So it would depend on what the document said.
Okay, and then just one final question on that. Say the business is owned by a couple, and obviously everything that they own in their personal life and then everything they own in their business life is intertwined. They still could walk away from debts that were incurred, say, on a company credit card versus their credit card that says, you know, Nancy Dahlstrom versus another one that says a business name?
Well, it would depend a lot on the facts, but the answer is the same. Even if it was a very closely held limited liability company that the husband and wife owned, and they had a small business they were operating through that company, and they, of course, also owned a number of personal assets, their home and investment accounts and vehicles and other personal assets, if the company was operated correctly, and if the obligation was incurred in the name of the company, And if there were no personal guarantees, and if eventually that company failed, generally the creditor could only go after the assets of the company and not the personal assets of its owners, which would be the husband and wife.
Okay, and I said one, I said I was final, but I have one more. Okay, so if there's no personal guarantee, if the business is operated correctly, and to me that's kind of a key phrase, if the business is operated correctly, there is potential then for somebody to come, put a lien against their personal, their home, you know, whatever else they have, this goes to court, and then a judge has to, or a jury, or depending on how big the situation is, has to decide if it was operated correctly or there was something criminally done wrong?
Well, and you may now be mixing both of the questions we talked about before. If, in the example we've been talking about, the husband or the wife was personally negligent or reckless or otherwise responsible for some type of event, then they could go after that person's personal assets as well as the business's assets. But in the example that I was just talking about, I was assuming that they had neither the husband or the wife had been negligent or otherwise acted wrongfully in incurring this debt, that it was merely a business that had failed. And that failure was the responsibility, just the reality that the business didn't succeed. And there were outstanding debts of that business that were greater than the business's assets. Then, as a general matter, those creditors could not go after the personal assets of the members, the husband and wife, unless those members had personally guaranteed the debts. Usually they don't, if they can avoid it.
Okay, I'm hearing you. I'm just going to have to do a little bit more research on. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And I hate to keep asking the same question, Mr. Sheftel, but I want to make sure I get it. I'm going back to the D, elimination of D.
Right.
And my example is this. Yeah. My wife and myself and my friend Bob are partners in an LLC, and all three of us have to agree before we can do anything, and it's an ongoing business. My kid gets sick, and my wife and I want some money out from the LLC. And my friend Bob tells me, he goes, I will agree to the cash disbursement if you will agree to amend the operating agreement or the articles of our organization and allow me to control everything. Now, with D, the current statute in there, you could not have an operating agreement and shut me and my wife out of my own business. If you eliminate D, could I get leveraged by my partner? And that's, I don't know how much more clear to make the question on that one.
Yes.
It's not a family trust question. It's an ongoing business. I want cash out. I need the money. I want you to sell, or I want the group, the LLC, to sell a couple pieces of real estate and to keep the money that I need. Could I get leveraged by my minority partner to change the articles of organization or the operating agreement of the company and lose control of my own company?
Yes. Good.
Well, you know, D only refers to C, and C only talks about amending the articles of organization or amending the operating agreement of the company.
Right.
And in your hypothetical, Representative Samuels, you are starting with a situation that could cause the same problem for you regardless of subsection D. And that is, your hypothetical involves an operating agreement that you've entered into, which essentially is a contract, that says that you're not going to change that agreement unless you have unanimous consent. So you've already got yourself in a box that you have to deal with minority owners in your situation, this non-family participant, on whatever you do. And that's unfortunate and probably is not the way the law sets it up. The law sets it up if you go up into subsection A or subsection B, the default rule here to the majority controls. If I'm understanding your hypothetical, you've already boxed yourself in a way you shouldn't have. And as a result of that, you've given a lot of power to this minority member. And I'm afraid if you get into that kind of a situation, you're going to end up litigating it to ask a judge for some equitable relief to get out of that LLC.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Groenberg, and then
yeah,
back.
No,
Mr. Schaftel, this is Representative Groenberg. That's true what you're saying, but under subsection C, it could apply even if there's nothing in the operating agreement or the articles of incorporation. The only thing that would save you under current law is subsection D. Subsection D is a default protection. And if we eliminate that, then the result that you've described could occur. But I don't think it could occur if we keep subsection D, and I'm very concerned about eliminating subsection D, because subsection C is, the normal rule is that the written consent of all members of the liability company, limited liability company, is required to do these several things. Unless it's otherwise required in the operating agreement or in the articles of incorporation. Subsection D would appear to be a floor of a majority, it looks to me like there is that the written consent is only required to a unanimous consent. Unanimous written consent is only required if you want to amend the articles or amend an operating agreement or authorize a manager to do the things listed there. But for other things generally, it looks like the default is not less than a majority level. Although these two subsections, C and D, are very confusingly written and seem to be in conflict. How do you harmonize them?
Well, through the chair, Representative Groenberg, I don't agree with you. I'm sorry. Going back to looking at subsection C, what it's saying first is, unless another level of member consent required in an operating agreement of the company, and so first thing is, in the operating agreement of the company, you can change the level of consent to whatever you want. But remember, an operating agreement is essentially a contract. And when you have a contract, usually you require the consent of all of the members of that agreement to change it. And as lawyers, we're very familiar with that. And that's all this subsection C is saying. It's talking about the articles of organization and the operating agreement of the company, which are the contracts that you enter into when you set up an LLC, just as if you entered into some kind of any other kind of business contract with any group of people. You go out and enter in and decide to buy a parcel of land, and there are four or five of you, and you all of you enter into a contract that has various terms. That contract can't be changed unless all of you agree to it. And that's all this subsection C is saying. The written consent of the members are required of all the members to amend this basic contract. And so all D is saying is that if you want to water that down and say, you know, we can set up a contract, and we can let less than all of the members who've entered into that contract change it, which is an unusual kind of thing to do, but sometimes people want to do it. And this unusual type of thing that we want to do it for family limited partnerships and family LLCs, because that's where we want to have a special manager. So it's first, it's highly unusual. Second thing is, it goes against all of our instincts as to an agreement. When we have an agreement, two, three, four, a dozen of us enter into agreement, we sign a document, we all understand that it can't be changed generally. We can't have new obligations or lose our rights under that agreement because just some of the members want that result. And that is why subsection C says it can't be changed unless all the members, unless you enter into a different agreement, written agreement. The basic default rule is all of the members are going to be required to change these two basic agreements that are central to an LLC, and that's the Articles of Organization and the Operating Agreement. Now, what D says, again, it's just this kind of rule that's saying, okay, you can water that down. If you want to set up a deal and there are 10 people involved, and you want to say that if six of them want to change the deal, the other four are just going to have to go along with the changes. If you want to set that up and people want to go in and sign a written agreement to that effect, then they can do it. But, and that's what subsection C already says, when it says unless another level of member consent is required. D is just saying you can't do that and go below six, you can't go to four. That's what it says. And that's the general concept, less than a majority. But first we're dealing with a very unusual situation. You would have to agree to it. You'd have to agree to it in writing. The problem with subsection D is it prevents us using family limited partnerships and family LLCs, and these are very, very common in the state of Alaska in many, many estate planning situations, and they're very, very common nationwide. And nationwide, the kind of planning I've described to you today, I mean, that's the solution to this tax problem. And if we don't allow this kind of solution in Alaska, then we are going to fall behind what's being done in other states. And many, many, many people are setting up LLCs in Alaska using our LLC law because it's so advantageous. So there's really no harm by repealing D. It is an anachronistic provision. It's not necessary, and it's very important to the kind of planning we're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
It looks to me, though, that D would allow an agreement to provide that a change could be made in the operating agreement or the articles of organization by less than a majority of the members. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that's correct. You would, if you wanted to go into that kind of an arrangement, then it would allow that.
And under current law, you can't.
Under current law, you can't go below a majority.
Through the chair, what is the benefit of making that change once again?
Benefit of making that change is you can have a situation where the older family members who, and this is relatively common, you and your wife set up a family LLC. It's for you, your wife, your children, your grandchildren. You put in substantial assets. You start making gifts of those assets, and you gift away, let's say, 45% of them before both of you die. if you don't have a special manager situation set up, the IRS is going to argue, if you are one of the managers, IRS is, or even if you just own an interest, you don't even have to be a manager. If you still own an interest, the IRS is going to argue all those assets should be included back into your estate and taxed. The 45% that you gave away are still going to be taxed to you. And that's what we're trying to avoid here.
Could it, through the chair, I understand what you're saying. Could the repealer, the fact that it would allow changes in the whole organization of the LLC to be made by less than a majority, would that not be potentially susceptible to misuse and abuse in another circumstance? I don't want you to look at the best case scenario. I want you to look at how this could be misused in the worst case scenario. Could it be misused?
Through the chair, I really, as a real world matter, do not see how that will occur. Because we are not saying, this is not a rule that says that less than a majority can change these agreements. This is a rule that says if you knowingly go into an arrangement, you read the agreement, you sign the agreement, and you, only then, if you agree that less than a majority could change the rules that you are bound to, would that situation apply? And that is true of every contract you enter into. I mean, there's no such rule out there that is designed to protect people in any other business organization or any other contractual arrangement that I am familiar with that says that if you go into it, read the agreement, and agree to terms that aren't to your advantage, knowingly, understand what you're doing. You always can get out of it, of course, and Representative Grunberg, you know this as well or better than I do, being an attorney, that you always can get out of it if there's been any kind of undue influence or duress or lack of adequate notice or lack of adequate representation, so you didn't know what you were doing. But assuming none of those things exist, the kind of hypothetical we've been discussing here could arise in any business setting. And it would be a shame because of that possibility, but that could arise in any business setting with any kind of agreement to not allow Alaskans to be able to take advantage of family limited liability companies and to suffer very substantial onerous tax consequences. Even though they have in good faith and followed all the rules in given away a substantial part of the assets of their entity.
Mr. Cheftel, there's a question from Representative Ramirez.
Hi, Mr. Cheftel. Thanks for joining us on the last day of our committee. I was in an LLC, and I now own 100% of it. I was in it 50-50. And for reasons I can't explain that cost me $1 million, I voted my 50% to make the other member a managing member, who proved to be an unscrupulous person, in my opinion. And I bought my freedom for quite a considerable cost. And so to a certain extent, I think that's exactly what you're talking about here, is that I foolishly, with my 50%, elected in the Articles of Incorporation and our operating agreement to make this other person the managing member, and then regretted it, by that afternoon or the next day. And so I gather that what you're saying is that the members of an LLC can do anything that they want in the operating agreement, and that the repeal of D has all these benefits that you listed out very well, and the only detriment is for somebody that like me that was stupid enough to do what I did, which at the time seemed like a wise decision and then became a regrettable one afterward. I don't see what harm the repeal of D does. I don't know if I have a question. Am I understanding things correctly?
Yes, exactly. And that, and all of us, of course, that after we've been around for a few years, have made bad business decisions and have regretted them. And unfortunately, statutes can't protect us from that. And that's exactly the case that we're talking about here. And you've described it perfectly.
So, well, to that end, I mean, the foolish thing for me was in the operating agreement to vote my 50% to make somebody else the managing member, but we didn't. The hostage taking and the that happened subsequent to that decision wasn't relative to D. It was just relative to the operating agreement that that we set up in the first place. So you can't. You know, God takes care of fools and babies, but it doesn't help us much when we do stupid things. And so there are considerable benefits that are enjoyed by Alaskans who choose to create an Alaskan LLC and to keep their capital in the state of Alaska. And the detriment is for people like me that did stupid things, but I did that in the operating agreement. So I don't it seems to me that we're maybe it's fatigue or something, but I think we're wrapped around the wrong axle is my own impression. D would not have neither helped me nor hurt me in with regard to managing my own stupidity in a business transaction. Is that right?
You don't need to comment to that.
I would say let the council make the judgment call.
Yeah.
Representative Samuels, have your questions been answered to your satisfaction?
I thank you, Madam Chair. The chairman was out of the room. The example that I gave was my wife and I and my friend Bob are partners in an LLC. My wife and I need to get some cash out of the LLC. Our child is sick. Bob said it's a unanimous vote, which maybe we shouldn't have set that up. So maybe Mr. Chaptel is right. You know, your own stupidity, don't set it up where you need a unanimous vote. But with a three-person partnership, it's a logical thing. So therefore, my friend Bob tells me, I should use a different example. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm going to take you to the cleaners.
Says if you change the operating agreement, I'll let you get the cash out. And once the operating agreement is there, I've lost my business because now he operates as a minority partner. And that's, you know, and people can say that's an absurd example, but that's what D seems to me to protect. I understand the family portion of it, which is probably more realistic, real-life situation, so I'm not going to offer an amendment to take this out or anything. But I am in a couple of LLCs, and I am a exact one-quarter partner, and we all get along very, very well. But
right
until you don't.
Until you don't.
Representative Ramirez.
But Representative Samuels, is there a managing member, and are there other members, or are all four of you managing members in your LLC? Because typically an LLC has a managing member.
Yes, as a managing member.
So the managing member has enormous authority relative to the other members when it comes to most activities, unless you're going to disturb the underlying operating agreement or something significant. And that, and Mr. Chaptal had asked you to weigh in on that because
he did. That's okay.
Is that where he
did?
Okay.
He did
okay.
While you were out. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not protected from my own stupidity.
And in my example, it wasn't stupidity. It was a desperate need for something from the company, which then I lost the control of the day-to-day operation of my company. However, I do understand, Mr. Chaptal, I do understand that 99% of this is going to be with the family, with the senior member of the family, and I get it. But it's still a concern that you could lose your company because of the majority vote if you set it up poorly and had trust when you should not have had in the first place.
Representative Ramirez.
Representative Samuels, did you just wake up like with kind of a no thing, no attitude today, or just kind of a no man today?
Abominable no man.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chaptal, what was the original the reason for originally having subsection D?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this act, you know, the provisions in our LLC Act came out of one of the early model acts that was being circulated and that was based on the partnership format. it, well, it was reviewed, and there were, you know, six or eight of us at the time reviewing it, wasn't reviewed very carefully. And so I can tell you where the source of it. Y'all could speculate as to what its purpose was. And I think we, you know, in our discussion, the purpose in my mind, just speculating, is that not to let the members of the LLC agree to an arrangement that involved allowing the amendment of the articles, organization, or the operating agreement by less than just a majority of the members. Probably a law professor sitting somewhere working on the Model Act did not deal with the real world and all of the other complications of the real world, thought that would be a good rule to put in there. But it's a policy decision, and where we are right now, in my view, the policy of allowing Alaska residents to take advantage of family limited partnerships and family LLCs greatly outweighs the limited type of protection that this provision, probably back 20 years ago, somebody thought was advisable.
Thank you.
All righty. Are there any other questions from the committee for Mr. Schaftel? Or it's Schaftel, isn't it? I apologize. Schaftel, okay. All righty.
Could I ask one more question?
Yes, one more, Representative Grunberg.
Is there a similar provision in the Limited Partnership Act that we should be looking at, too?
And that is to Mr. Schaftel?
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, right now in Alaska, when we form these family entities, I shouldn't give you a long-winded answer. The answer is I don't know. I'd have to go back and check on it.
Don't worry about it then. Thanks.
Okay.
If you send Representative Grunberg a memo on that, he'll disperse it to us, and then we'll all learn something from it. Are there any other questions that members have for the presenter of the bill? All righty, and I'm understanding Judiciary is the one and only committee of referral in the House on this. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All righty. The fiscal note is zero. I would entertain a motion.
So.
Any objections? All right, seeing none, the Senate Bill number 141, version A with attached physical note and individual recommendations is moved from committee.
Thank you. And before we wind up our first day, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'd like to take another opportunity on the record to thank Jane Pearson and Barbara Cotting. And is there more? And Emily Stancliffe for all of their work this session, particularly Jane, in keeping us organized and helping us to move such a volume of work product and almost all of it high caliber work product, and a number of the bills that we didn't move. And then the last piece of business for today, we need to... we need to rescind our adoption of, we need to go back to, Susan, we want to go back to HJR 2. We want to rescind our adoption of version E as amended. Would somebody move that, please, and then I will go into the details.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we rescind our action on...
maybe it's version K. Looks like it's version
H.
It was K.
HJR number 2, version K. Version E as in Eric.
Okay. All right. We've rescinded version E as amended, and now the chair would entertain a motion to adopt version K.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to... Go ahead. To move that, make the motion that we move the CS for House Joint Resolution number.
We can just adopt it.
Oh, I apologize.
Just adopt version K.
I move to adopt version K.
And I'm going to object for discussion only. Despite what Mr. Lockhart says in his memo, the language that we have now, if the members would look at version E and compare it to version K, on line 11 of version E.
Representative Grunberg, I don't think that we have version E in front of us. We only have the K version. Oh, I don't have the E version.
Oh, this was the one we dealt with. Yes, I'll read it to you.
Right.
What it said was that the vote for the gaming or gambling must be, quote, approved by the municipality, comma, if any, comma, where the gaming or gambling may occur. And we changed that.
Yeah, well, okay.
Good point. We changed that. Originally it said will occur, and we changed in an amendment to it to read, and approved by any municipality where the gaming or gambling may occur. And what they have done now, the drafters, have said, and approved by the municipality where the gaming or gambling may occur. And this made a change, which I think is a beneficial change, but I want to put it on the record, to require that the operation occur in a municipality. The way it had been before, it could occur outside a municipality, and we talked about that, just operating outside the city limits. And this requires it now to be in a municipality, which puts an additional control. But I wanted the members to understand that. I think that's a good idea.
Representative Dahlstrom?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you recall, the other prime co-sponsor and I, that is our original intent, and it was just a misuse of a word, our mistake, and we're grateful that we have it fixed.
So you want it to be in a municipality?
To tighten it up, yes, so that
good.
They can control their area.
Let
absolutely.
It be done if the sponsor wants gaming to be in a municipality.
Mr. Chair, let it be known that I would like every or any municipality to have a vote before any of that is ever allowed.
Cheap shot.
Representative Grunberg, do you?
I remove my objection.
Very well.
Thanks.
And we have the The K version is before us. Are there any changes or discussion on the K version? All right, seeing none, I'd entertain a motion to move the K version from the committee.
Go ahead, if you like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move the CS for House Joint Resolution Number 2, version K, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Right, seeing no objection, HJR 2, the K version moves from committee. All right, and that winds up our work for the session.
You're pretty sure we're not
Mr. Chair,
any other bills?
I'd like to thank you for running a very good committee here. Appreciate it. Honor to be honored.
Thank you, Representative Leonard. It's an honor to serve with you. Are there any other remarks from any members as we wind things up?
We have hours left, so keep your powder dry.
Anything can be put in front of us.
And I discovered
my powder's dry, and so with that, at 3:05, we are adjourned for the day.